Okay, here we go. Chama people, and welcome to our 234th episode of Happiness and Darkness, the superhero movie podcast, where we discuss superhero movies from Marvel, DC, Dark Horse Image, and more. Naturally, there will be spoilers, folks, so you have been warned. I am one of your hosts, Janek, and as always, joining me is my podcasting partner in crime and wonderful friend, Mr. Keith Bliss. Hey, Keith, how are you today?
Oh, I can't complain. It's finally warming up down here in the South, so I'll be outside working on my tan lines soon enough. So all things being considered, it's a good start to the week.
Fantastic stuff. Anyway, I'm glad that you're going to be working on your tan lines there. Speaking of actually working on your tan lines, in this case, I guess these could be creatures that will return to dust when it comes to the sunshine, most of them. Today, we are discussing Vampire Hunter D from 1985. This was directed by Toyo Ashida. The screenplay was by Yasushi Hirano, while the score was by Tetsuya Komuro. So I know this was obviously, this didn't really sort of have a budget or anything like that. It kind of just was released to the public, if you will. So getting to general impressions here, Keith, I know this wasn't the first time you sat down with this. So what did you make of Vampire Hunter D, and were you familiar with the source material?
I had not read the source material that this is based on. When I discovered this, I think it was early 90s, and it was off a recommendation of an employee at the video store in the mall I worked in. Yes, kids, you could buy crap like this in the mall back in the day. Not so much anymore. But I bought this, I watched it, and I fell in love with it almost immediately. I was a big fan of this style of artwork. I have watched other styles of this anime in the genre, and that'll go toward my recommendations. But this reminds me of a lot of some other animes that I was a big fan of. So when I watched this, and who doesn't like a good vampire, you know, anime for all this craziness? This, I would say, was almost a precursor to our favorite Marvel superhero, Blade, in terms of live action. Blade technically came out before this, but this was the first exposure I had to vampire hunters. And it drew me in because of all the craziness and the chaos. The fact that he has a hand that's a sentient being that talks to him, which you just assume through half of this animation that it's like just a voice in his head or some other, like his weapon or something talking to him. Nope, it is literally his hand. Which is kind of funny because the hand does save his life. It becomes kind of dependent on it to get him out of some sticky situations. It's the ultimate plot armor, his literal hand. He gets attacked by a spell, the hand absorbs it. He gets killed, the hand brings him back to life. So while it seems crazy in the continuity of this Vampire Hunter D universe, it makes 100% sense. With that being said, I wish they had explained a little bit more of his backstory, how he got the hand. Was he always like this? Was this something that happened on one of his earlier adventures? They just kind of throw you right in the deep end. So you just have to kind of piece things together. And it's not until the last minute, half of the movie that you find out who his father is, and the lineage that he comes from. And then you're like, oh crap. Okay. That explains why he can do certain things that he does. I liked everything. I will say it's definitely a product of its time and has not necessarily aged very well. I think if this were redone nowadays, not changing the style, just changing the pacing and adding a little bit more to it, I think they could flush out the universe a little bit better.
I think you make a great point because I thoroughly enjoyed this myself. And this was the first time I sat down to watch this or heck had even heard of this particular property. I think I do agree when you say there are certain things one kind of wishes there was an explanation for, i.e. the symbiote hand. I mean, because like you said, when we first kind of are introduced to this concept, at first, yeah, we just sort of hear this voice and we're like, okay, does he have a voice? Like you said, does he have a voice in his head? Is it something like because he is, a, you know, almost like the version of a daywalker, if you were a dampier, if you will, he might have these ultrasensorial things, or maybe has like a hive mind. It's hard to say. And yeah, we're kind of just thrown directly into the action from the get-go. I mean, I understand this was based like on one volume of the first volume of Vampire Hunter D when it comes to the manga. So I'm thinking that what they must have done is, which they tend to do with quite a few anime movies, is they take the highlights from the various issues and then mash them all together into a movie that will run for about 1 hour, 20 minutes, hour and a half, which is the runtime of this movie. And it very much felt like that, because there were moments where I'm like, okay, how did we get from this to this? How did this happen and why did this happen? And so I'm like, okay, it's very much in the style of anime when they do a feature length of a series of comics that they put out. And so it definitely felt like we're that way, like we're giving you the cliff notes of the first volume of Vampire Hunter D. So I'm sure there's tons of extra stuff in it. When it comes to style, I can definitely tell how it influenced more modern things that have come out recently. I think, for example, Castlevania, where the style is very similar to this, and also the themes are very similar. There's that very sexualized element. There's obviously all the blood and guts and what have you, but just the style of it, I have a feeling this may have influenced the folks who did the Castlevania shows. And I love Castlevania, so this was something that I really enjoyed watching. And the other thing was how kind of they play very much fast and loose, both, as I said, the violence and the sex, where I'm like, I see now, I have always seen anime censored, because here we literally have full frontal female nudity and all sorts of weird things going on. So I guess the anime that we got over here were all watered down immensely and were all censored. And obviously here there's no censorship whatsoever, because obviously you get to see raw blood, you get to see, women's animated breasts, you see all the whole thing. Okay, this is cool. And then the story itself I thought was very interesting. It also followed the tropes and traits of many manga and anime that I've seen. Another one that comes to mind is Fist of the North Star, which is kind of similar to the way this story is shown and some of the characters. And I'll be referring to Fist of the North Star quite a bit when I come to the when we get to our characters. But yeah, I thought it was great, and it definitely made me want to watch, other iterations of this, like the more modern take of it, like Bloodlust, like I believe is the follow-up to this. So I'd like definitely love to see it. So before we get to our characters, was there anything else you wanted to add, Keith?
No, I did not realize that you guys were that censored when it came to anime. And that does happen here from time to time because it was a little over the top, depending on the type of anime style that you were watching. So I being a product of the 80s and 90s, it's not really a shock that they toned it down in different parts of the world.
Well, especially with the nudity, because we know
Oh,
that, as
heck
I
yes.
said, I watched Dragon Ball Uncensored for the first time. Dragon Ball Z, etc. I'm like, wow, they really censored a lot.
They did that here in the States as well when it was on TV. So anytime there was blood, it was just they'd open their mouth and be like bleh, and nothing would come out. But then if you'd ever watch the uncensored version, you'd see them just puking blood out in their guts and everything. So they did water that down for the States, and why there are several iterations of Dragon Ball and some other animes kicking around.
This is very true. So I guess then, getting to our characters on the board, let's start by looking at our protagonist. At least when it comes to the English dubbed version, we have Michael McConaughey as D, and that's not obviously the text of the guy, that's Matthew, and it's spelt differently, folks. So when it comes to our hero here, Keith, what did you make of D?
He's man of few words.
Sure is.
With that being said, I get it. It's the stereotypical strong, silent type, speak softly but carry a big stick. And he literally carries a sword that's got to be every bit of what, 15 feet long. And he does not say a lot. He is very soft spoken. But when he does talk, it's very short to the point. And then other times he kind of like her, the main character, her little brother, he's sitting there talking to him, like, and he's showing a sensitive side. So he's not all just rough and murder and tough guy. And what I appreciated about this style of animation was D is a slender individual. He's a tall, slender man. So you don't think he is as powerful as he truly is because of, again, his lineage being the son of Dracula. So when you see him, you're like, oh, he's just going to get murdered. And he does, he gets cut up a little bit, but he quickly regenerates, and that's when they realize he's a vampire. But every time he walks into a room, everybody underestimates him. And he just shows him up every time, which I get it, that was kind of the trope of its day. But it worked in this context, it worked very well. And anytime you saw him interact with the character, even some of the bad guys were a very slender build, just like him, just a little bit more muscular. He, on the other hand, was just like straight as a pole and carried a giant sword. So his interaction with all the characters around him, even with the young lady, same thing. He was that brooding type. And she's like, "Oh, I've fallen for him. I'm madly in love." And you're just like, very cliche. So you get that groan. You're like, "Oh, really? We're gonna go this route?" But at the same time, it doesn't take away from the story too much. You know, she does swoon over him, but that's very common for the stereotypical damsel in distress, and it goes both ways. I've seen it where the strong female character saves a male character and he swoons over her. So it's not just, you know, girl swoons over boy. It actually works in both dynamics. So that being said, she was decent enough. She was basically just kept getting captured all the time. So she was just there to basically get Dracula's, D rather, from point A to point B to point C, and just kind of keep the story moving. Without her, you'd still probably have a decent story, but after a certain point, he would have killed everybody and just moved on. So he had to keep saving her from different situations, which does get a little, you know, tiresome after a certain point. But thankfully, the movie is quick enough paced and enough going on that you're just like, all right, fine, we're done. And then we have 5 minutes of him walking off into the sunset.
That's exactly it. And that's why, as I said, it is very reminiscent of, if you will, almost the wandering samurai or the wandering warrior, which we've seen in many an anime and many a manga. Case in point, as I mentioned earlier, Fist of the North Star, where you have the main character Kenshiro, who, you know, will go from town to town. Obviously, you know, he has an ultimate goal, which is to find Julia, the woman that he loves, but he will go from town to town, you know, and he'll rid whatever city of the local villain or the local warrior, and then, you know, just walk off again into the sunset. And I love the fact that, I mean, I know this is not a Fist of the North Star episode, but unlike here, whenever whenever he bursts his clothes because he's so muscular, the next day he's got the same clothes back on. Like, there must be a tailor who follows him around.
He's got a suitcase often like stuck behind a rock somewhere where he just like beats everybody's ass and like puts a new t-shirt on. Because you think about it, he's going to be covered in blood anyway. So get rid of the shirt, take a shower, move on.
And it's always the same blue ensemble that Ken wears all the time, which I think is fantastic. But and D,
For
I
all we
think it,
know, it
yeah.
could be mutant pants and it just regrows. Like it's some of those cartoons where they have symbiote clothes and stuff like that. It just, he's regrows clothes every morning. It's like bing, magic.
I guess it's one of the other secrets of the Holy School of Okuto, I suppose, is to be able to recreate clothes. But at least that doesn't happen with D here. But there are a lot of similarities, I think, between D and Ken, in the sense that brooding hero, the guy who, a man of few words, who will impart wisdom to characters here and there, or say something particularly poignant. He never wastes his breath to say something silly or something stupid. He's always that kind of very wise and stalwart warrior who will just, you know, when he speaks, he makes it count. And he does this, and D does this throughout the whole film, whether he's imparting wisdom to Dan Lang or whether he's talking to the Countess, it's always something very important that he has to say. So it's you know, we could probably learn from D, I think a lot of us, myself included, of maybe speak when you have something interesting or important to say rather than just air your teeth, as my father would say. So or give your teeth an airing. But no, I love this character. And I mean, obviously, loving Fist of the North Star, I love this because the traits are very similar. And like you said, also is very reminiscent of Blade too, because the Daywalker concept, which they've kind of done here, where I suppose, even though here they don't talk about vampires, they only talk about vampirism. So I guess or they couldn't use the word vampire and they couldn't use vampirism. It's an interesting concept because they just call them noble. The vampires just known as nobles. And so I'm like, that's an interesting concept. I wonder whether they couldn't use the word, but they clearly could because it's in the title. But I guess because it's like a post-apocalyptic world where you have mutants and monsters and what have you, and these are mutants in their own way, vampires who have kind of taken over the world, which is also a very typical thing that you will find in anime and manga, post-apocalyptic situation where people have either gained powers because of it or are trying to struggle through this world where you have the warriors and you have the rich and powerful who are horrible. And also in this case, the rich and powerful are horrible, and we're rooting for the common people, which, as I said, I guess is clearly something which is very inherent to manga and anime culture, which is a great thing. You know, I appreciate. But yeah, the character of D, I thought, was great. And he was also, and Michael did a great job in voicing him. Granted, he has very few lines, but the lines he does have are definitely cool. And I'm like, yeah, wise old man. I love this dude. He's fantastic. So let's look at two other members of Team D on this adventure. We have a Barbara Goodson as Doris Lang and Lara Cody as Dan Lang. So Keith, I know you expressed some of your thoughts when it came to Doris. Did you have anything else to add when it came to her? And what did you make of Dan?
I can appreciate what they were trying to do with these two characters. There's, supposed to be the strong, or she's at least supposed to be the strong, independent woman, which she is. I'm not taking away from that. Do not misconstrue anything I'm saying here, ladies and gentlemen in the audience. What I'm saying is she just kept making poor life choices through this entire movie. It was, oh, okay, I'll just go do that, and doesn't question anything ever. Or when she finally does make some sort of demand, they're like, okay. Literally, she just had to say, don't kill so and so and so and so. And they're like, fine. And she gets in the carriage and goes off. And then D saves her 10 minutes later, 20 minutes later, whatever the case may be. And then right back into it, what, 15 minutes after that, or the next day, in terms of Vampire D World, she gets kidnapped by the doctor who had been turned into a vampire the night before. And you're like, okay, we're gonna go this route. And then something else happens. So it's, they don't really let her shine in terms of her strength as a character. It's one of those, she should have potentially, being a daughter of a, I think it was a werewolf hunter or something to that effect, that she'd be a little more wary of things because she theoretically has seen some shit in her day. But meanwhile, she's like, nope, everything's okay, and just off, and there we go. So it's like, that seems a little suspect. And then her little brother is just naive because he is very young. He hasn't seen any of the things that she has seen or done. So I get him crying and bawling his eyes out when he finds out that his sister's been bitten by a vampire, because to him, that's the end of the world. She's now going to become a vampire, and he is stuck. He's lost his sister, and so on and so forth. And D is there to console him. He's like, let it out, cry. But your sister's going to need to, you need to be strong for your sister because she's going to be going through some shit. And lo and behold, she does. And he is always there to support her, which I appreciate as the younger sibling. So the dynamic between the two of them was great. I like that. It's just some of the decisions that were made during the course of this movie were a little questionable. And I get it, they need to do these or make these mistakes, or else obviously we wouldn't need D to come bail her out and kill her vampire noble in her region. So I get it.
Yeah, I mean, and you make some great points there, because they could have done a lot more with Doris, but I think what they were maybe doing, they were playing up to the stereotypes that we've seen in many a vampire film, where you tend to have these voluptuous, beautiful women who are kind of there to either be saved or be sacrificed and don't really get to hold their own, where it's very much a male-dominated situation, because obviously, the vampire and the allure of the vampire and what have you. But yeah, I mean, she could definitely have held her own given the chance. There, you've mentioned questionable things. There was something that I thought was rather questionable right at the top of this movie, is aside from the great intro we get of that random woman who I guess just disappears and dies, just to give us an idea of what a dangerous world we're living in, when Doris shows up, she's wearing a mini skirt and just panties and in a storming gale. And I'm like, she's going to die of cold like that. I mean, how long? How long has she been standing there? Because it's a while before Dee rides by. She's literally standing in the middle of the road with this crazy wind, and she's like, literally almost naked, if you will. And like, you're probably going to catch yourself a death like that. I mean, wear something a little bit longer, maybe. I mean, I understand the fact of course, she has to look sexy. She has to look alluring, maybe because she's also trying to pitch to Dee that she wants his services, and she's even prepared, to offer him her body in exchange for like being her vampire hunter. But at the same time, like, that's not very practical. Also, from a warrior standpoint, it could be an element of distraction, as we have seen, female characters do, to where they wear figure-hugging clothing to where it can almost distract their opponent, and so it allows them to get, have that extra edge, if you will. But I was like, she's must be freezing to death. I just wanted to lean into the screen and give that poor girl a coat. So I'm like, she's going to be frozen, by the time. And Dee doesn't even care two whits about that. He just goes, just kind of looks at her and then just does his thing. But I guess maybe she's such a great warrior, she doesn't feel the cold. I don't know. Other than that, yeah, the fact that she kind of throws herself at Dee a little bit and falls in love, like you said, is a little bit tropey. But it does also, I think, give us the opportunity to see a temptation of Dee, the fact that he is half vampire. And so when he sees her neck, he starts kind of, getting all hot under the collar and is almost giving in to that side of himself, kind of like Blade, if you will, who has to obviously take serum in order to stave off the hunger for blood. And we see that clearly Dee is just going on pure willpower. He's not taking any kind of supplement. He still probably would drink blood if he gave in to that side of himself. And Doris is almost like that temptation element of, you could turn on the dime, D could become a villain very quickly, but in the end, obviously, he pulls back. Other than that, I mean, yeah, that's really kind of what she's there to do, and also kind of play the damsel in distress when she gets kidnapped by the Count and then is ostensibly about to marry him. But other than that, yeah, I would have liked a little bit more from Doris. When it came to Dan, you've very accurately put it perfectly there. He is very naive. He's a young kid. He's obviously, I guess, he and his sister trying to get by in this vampire-ridden world and just trying to make a living, I suppose. I have no idea what they do to make money. I have no idea. I guess they live off the land. It's hard to say how they have an income to where they can afford what they have. Or even when we see Doris going to buy supplies, it's like, where do you get that money from? I have no idea. But it's all her parents left her something in their will when they died. I do not know. But
She's independently wealthy. We just never realized it.
I guess so. I guess she's independently wealthy in some way. And yeah, Dan is the very much naive guy, and he obviously sees in Dee something to aspire to, possibly because of the fact that he's so cool and he's such a great warrior and he imparts these great words of wisdom to him. So he very much is like a kind of fanboying over Dee a little bit. But he's a young kid. I think we all would if we were in Dan's situation. So he basically is that. And it'll be interesting to then revisit these characters like 10, 12 years later and seeing what kind of a man Dan has grown into. And whether he is, a hunter himself or other such things, or what happens to Doris, or what, because there'll always be that question, is will we see these characters again, or are they just people that happen to pass into Dee's life and then pass out of his life when he goes on to the next adventure? But I like these two. I said, yeah, Doris could have been developed a little bit more, and Danya, he's kind of the kid that you see in quite a few movies where you have this amazing superhero come into town. So I guess then let's round off our characters by looking at our two nobles in title only, of course. We have Eddie Merman, or Edie Merman, pardon me, as Countess Larmica Lee, and Jeff Wiglas as Count Magnus Lee. So what do you make of our two vampires, Keith?
It was interesting in the respect that you had like the cranky old guy who's been around and forever and ever, and he's very much like that guy, Dracula. There you go. That's what I'm looking for. You could see that he's restless. Things have happened, and he's just nothing surprises him anymore. And even when he does have a daughter, he forgets to tell her that she's a half-blood vampire like Vampire Hunter D, which is bizarre. You think she would have figured that out because he's not aging and she is, even though they, I'm going to imagine they age at a slower rate, something should have clicked. They're like, wait, why am I getting older and dad's staying the same age? Like, certain things should have been telltale signs. I do appreciate the fact that she, as the quote unquote noble vampire that she thought she was very hesitant to have dad take on a commoner as a wife, or the fact that her stepmom, it would be however many years older. And it's a very typical dynamic that daddy's little girl dislikes daddy's new girlfriend and does everything in her power to try to break them up. In this case, she literally tries to kill them, but that's a whole different issue. I think it's another one of those things where, like you and I have mentioned before, for the sake of time, they cut out a lot of the backstory. And you don't see a lot of these little details that probably would make more sense if you read all 74 chapters of the manga or whatever, however many there are. And you're like, oh, that explains what this is, and that explains what this is, and why we got where we are. So I think, again, a little more backstory opposed to pissed off daughter hating dad for trying to, bang somebody half his age. We're watching American Beauty Vampire Edition.
I think that's an excellent comparison, though, and it's very true when it comes to the dynamic between the Countess and the Count. There was something odd when it came to the Countess, in the sense when it came to the way Edie was voicing her, because there were times when it seemed like she didn't have much of an accent, and there were others where she went to this very strong, posh British accent, and
I did notice that too. It was all over the place, kind of.
yeah. Well, I'm like, sometimes she almost sounded American, and in other cases, she sounded like, as I said, she was speaking the Queen's English. So I'm like, I don't know whether they did different takes at different times. And so Edie had forgotten the accent that she used at the time, and maybe they filmed it out of order. But, because towards the end of the film, the Countess has that c constant British accent to kind of, I guess, add that air of superiority and of the regal nature, if you will, because a lot of people tend to associate, and I guess because they think of the royal family, they tend to associate the English accent with being regal and being part of aristocracy. And while her dad has just like a typical kind of, American accent, it's like, okay, I guess her mother was probably the Brit of the two. I do not know. But other than that kind of mismatch there of Edie's accent, she did a good job in voicing her. And yeah, for her, it's all about the purity of the race. When it comes to, we won't soil ourselves with commoners, or we won't drink the blood of commoners and what have you. But at the end of the day, what are you going to do? If it's a city full of peasants, you're going to feast on them anyway. If not, you're going to die. You have to kind of pick your battles when it comes to that. But I guess the fact that, yeah, if she would see a commoner's family, that just would never work for her because she's so obsessed with, we are superior. We're the nobles. We don't want to mess with commoners. And then, of course, the horror when she discovers that she is also part mortal herself, and that her mother was immortal. In fact, I love how the Count, in just a very sort of matter-of-fact way, tells like, oh, stop complaining like that. Your mother was a human as well. And just the way he throws it at her with such abandon, if you will, it really breaks something in the Countess, who was, I think, her whole life thought she was above everybody else because she had this. She was almost like, in her mind, she was born a vampire, to where she didn't wasn't turned, if you will. But like you said, I guess growing up, she probably should have realized that, maybe I'm not as high and mighty as I think I am. And I think it's that trauma that causes her to then sacrifice herself, to where she could save herself from the crumbling castle, and she's like, no. The line of the Lees has to end here, because I think I think maybe puts it forward as almost a noble thing of, we're such an evil bunch of people, we just have to be done away with, and so I will die, I will go down with the ship. Or it could be down to her trauma of, I'm not as pure as I thought I was. I can't live with myself anymore, so I'm just gonna allow the castle to bury me. And that'll be the end, if you will. I mean, I'm still in two minds about that, but I guess it could go either way. And when it comes to Count, yeah, he is very much your, I guess, run-of-the-mill vampire, horrible nobleman who holds tyranny over a village, who really has no interest or love for other people, and is just all about satisfying himself and what he needs. So he is very much that overlord, and I think it very much just illustrates that whole concept of the haves and the have-nots, where the haves are horrible people and the have-nots, you for the most part, are all nice and good, because we don't really see a good person, if you will, when it comes to the nobles, aside from D, who I guess walks in both worlds. He's the in-between man between, if you will, the commoners and the nobles, because he's kind of a bit of both. And I think he kind of breaks that kind of line between the two. But yeah, Magnus got on my nerves so much. I was kind of glad when he finally died, because like, I mean, he was, well, Jeff Winkless did a great job in voicing him, to the point where I'm like, I can't wait for him to get his own. And of course he does. And like, okay, that's what you get. And I was really happy about it. And the fight, I thought, between D and Magnus could have gone on a little bit. And it seemed like it was getting really sort of interesting. And then, of course, we have the 5-minute rule, and the count is done away with because we have to wrap up the movie. And I really would love to see how it went when it came to the manga. Maybe it was like 8 chapters all devoted to the fight between Magnus and D. But by and large, I enjoyed, the telekinesis and everything else. It was cool. And I thought it was made for a good fight. But I would have liked maybe just a little bit more, and I would have been a happy camper. Did you have anything else you wanted to add, Keith?
No, I agree with you 100%.
Oh, okay. So I guess then, if there's nothing else when it comes to this movie, let's get to ratings then. What do you give Vampire Hunter D out of 10, Keith?
Decisions, decisions. I'm of two minds. It has not aged well, so I'm taking a couple of points off for that, but I think I'm gonna have to give it an 8.5. It's a lot of fun. It's relatively, and I'm using air quotes here, guys, relatively accurate to the manga. Yes, they took the broad story points out of it and they left all the minor details out, but in terms of what happens in the story, this is more accurate than, say, some of the other adaptations we have seen along the lines.
And that's also a great segue into the movie we will be discussing next week, because they definitely take quite a lot of departures when it comes to that one. But more on that shortly. I'm going to also give this an eight out of 10 as well. I did enjoy it, and I'm likely going to be checking out the newer versions. And most likely, folks, you will be hearing us talk about them on this podcast. But as a first introduction to the character, I really enjoyed it. Like you, I think it could have had a little bit more fat to it, a little bit more meat. But they really were giving us, like you said, the highlights, and but like they do, as we said, in any anime, which is like, I've seen like the Dragon Ball movie, for example. It literally goes through this, 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 and this happened, and it doesn't really sort of give you all the nuances and the backstories of some of the characters. It's just like, here's how we got here. Boom. It's like previously on Dragon Ball, 1 hour, an hour and a half movie. And I don't really tend to like those. I tend to actually prefer to watch the animes episode by episode, even though they're like 50 minutes long and it takes, 20 seasons to get through from point A to point B, but I kind of prefer it that way. That's just my 2 cents. So I guess then, getting to recommendations, what would you like to recommend to our lovely listeners today, Mr. Keith?
Oh, I have so many. I apologize. If you liked this one, then definitely check out the follow-up they did, the Vampire Hunter D Bloodlines. I would tell you to check out, there was an anime series called Trinity Blood, which is another post-apocalyptic vampire, blah, 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 blah. MD Geist is another one. Ninja Scroll, which was same art style and drawing style as this one. Both Ninja Scrolls, actually. And I'll finish off with Hellsing, the original, not Ultimate. While Ultimate is truer to the story, there's just so much monologuing it takes away from it. So I'm sticking all in the anime. I would also say check out the manga version of this, just because, again, has more details, and this is only like the first, I don't know, dozen or so chapters. So there's a lot more going on in the world.
There certainly is, and great recommendations as always, Keith. I will add to those if you want to see what Netflix did when it came to their vampire stories. As I mentioned before, check out the two Castlevania series, if you will. There was Castlevania and Castlevania Nocturne, and I am eagerly awaiting the second part of Nocturne to arrive. It very much is similar to this. You can see the influences of this. I mean, the style is very much as in an anime version, if you will, when it comes to Netflix. But the spe should we say the special effects, I can't really call it visual effects, if you will, are just great. The CGI they use there is absolutely fabulous. And the stories are really compelling. And it has everything that you could want in a good, I guess, vampire story. You've got the blood and guts, you've got the sex, you've got good stories, you've got characters to root for, characters to hate. A lot of politics, so it's definitely a fab series indeed. And if you haven't checked them out, as both Keith and I mentioned, also go and check out the Blade movies. While we wait, of course, for Mahershala Ali's Blade to show up, maybe check out the Blade trilogy, if you will. Maybe one and two over Trinity, but that's just my personal preference. If you want to check out all three, by all means, go at it. But I would possibly suggest Blade and Blade Two. So, of course, dear listeners, if you wish to share your thoughts on the movies we discuss here, by sh you or even have questions for us, you can do so by shooting us an email, and that email address is happinessanddarknesshow@gmail.com. Once again, happinessanddarknesshow@gmail.com. You can show your support by giving us a like on Facebook, where you'll find us as Happiness and Darkness, or you can also follow us as X, formerly known as Twitter, or at High Darkness Pod. And last but not least, if you are listening to us on such platforms as Spotify or Apple Podcasts, be sure to rate and review us, as this helps the show grow, keeps the algorithm stimulated, and of course allows our little podcast to reach even more like-minded ears like yours. And of course, a big thank you to those who have done that, and a future thank you to those who will. So, Keith, when you're not here discussing vampire action in or any form or shape, where can folks find you on the interwebs?
You can usually find me hunting under rocks for good tidbits of dark information. But when I'm not doing that and trying to take over the world, you can listen to me on the Hour of Comics is Upon Us with Jason Gurren and John Seymour. We are finally getting back into the swing of things. We're doing a recording, I believe, this week of a interesting story. I won't spoil it, but I pitched it to the guys, and it's another classic first appearance of a character, so I hope y'all like it. I was also on what was it, Star Trek, the Undiscovered podcast. That was last week. That was a fun DS9 discussion podcast, so definitely check those guys out. You can find them on Spotify, YouTube, and every other magical platform known to man. And then obviously I'm on our Facebook page. You guys can drop a comment, a message, whatever the case may be. I'm always ready, willing, and able to talk about anything comic book, science fiction, sci-fi, manga, anime. Pick your poison.
Fabulous stuff. And I might be, a little bit biased when I say this, but any podcast that features Keith Bliss is worth listening to. He always does a great job. He's a very knowledgeable man when it comes to all things geeky and nerdy. So definitely check out wherever he is featured, be it Hour of Comics is Upon Us or the recent episode of Star Trek, the Undiscovered podcast. When it comes to me, folks, for you country music lovers, you can find me hosting the radio show Whiskey and Cigarettes, where we play the very best and nothing but the best of country music for you guys, from Alabama to Zac Brown. And for more information about that, you can visit our website, which is whiskeyandcigarettesshow.com. When it comes to podcast land, you can find myself, Rachel Friend, and Zan Sprouse on Gold Standard, the Oscars podcast, where we're reviewing all the best picture winners in chronological order. At the moment, we are all caught up. Finally, we know that the 96th Best Picture is Oppenheimer, so we will be reviewing that soon. But this week, however, before we get to Oppenheimer, we will be reviewing Defending Your Life, of course, a Albert Brooks movie, and of course, starring Meryl Streep as well. And the rather curious movie it is. I will save my thoughts for when we review that one this coming Thursday, as of this recording. And last but certainly not least, myself and Charles Skaggs will be returning to the fandom zone in June. So it's a couple of months to wait before we do that. But we will be returning to review the second, the rather second, the latest season of The Boys. Very excited about that and to see where things go when it comes to that comic book adapted TV show. And speaking of things to come on this show, we will be staying in the anime manga realm, but live action. Because next time, we'll be taking on a franchise that was very near and dear to me. And I was very excited when this film came out. I won't reveal my thoughts about this version, but it will be the 2023 Tomik Baginski film, Knights of the Zodiac. Or as folks in the anime and manga land might know, of course, the original title, Saint Seiya. So, Keith, anything else you'd like to add on our upcoming movie or anything else before we sign off?
This should be an entertaining watch. This is my first time viewing it, so I'm going in completely fresh and have no idea what's going on, but I already have some certain expectations.
But we'll see then. I guess this time the tables have been turned. Then I get to introduce you to a movie, and we'll have to see whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. But at least, you know, it's my chance to introduce you to something. So I'm glad I could do that for you. Hopefully, it won't be, you know, you won't be like, I'll never get those 2 hours back. But we shall see when next week rolls around. That said, folks, thanks as always for this show and supporting us. And of course, support, you know, appreciating us. We really, really do appreciate you guys. We will, of course, see you next time with Knights of the Zodiac. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. Stay super. Ciao, my people. And that is a wrap. Yay.
Yay, woo.